Hello and welcome to the Green Room at Furnitubes. I'm your host, Catherine Barrett, and we're here every month with a new episode. Join us for industry musings, interviews, and discussions exploring all things landscape architecture, street furniture, and urban design. Hi, I'm Catherine Barrett and this is The Green Room. I'm joined today by Graham Edwards, Managing Director and Founder of Edward Architecture, and Tim Reed, Director and Founder of Urban Wilderness, both based in Leeds. And we're here to talk today about the Holbeck Viaduct in Leeds. And this is a really great community-led campaign to transform an iconic viaduct into a great green space everyone can enjoy. So welcome, Graham and Tim. How are you?
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having us.
Hi, Catherine. Yeah, very well. Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about the project? You know, give everyone a bit of background to the Holbeck Viaduct, its history, and how the idea of this revival of it or its transformation came about.
The railway viaduct was built in 1882 for the London and Western Railway. The last trains that were used on the viaduct were in the early 80s. It's 1.7 kilometres long. It's got 92 brick arches on it. It is in a very good structural condition. It's got a lot of landscaping that's grown on it over the last 20 or 30 years or so. The big vision really is to open up this as a high-level urban walkway, parkway, cycleway that will link communities. It's got an end point and a start point, lots of pop-up points. So as well as just people popping up there, sitting down and having a sandwich, it actually goes from A to B. The two ends of the viaduct would be near Elm Road Football Stadium and Leeds City Centre near Leeds Station. So it's got that kind of community resilience that it will get used if it's done right. I think it can be not just a local park, a local walkway. I think it can actually be more than that. It can be a bit of a tourist attraction for the city. If you've ever been to New York, there's a project called the New York High Line. I think people who go to New York now actually put this on their bucket list for the visit.
Yeah, absolutely.
They go, right, I'm going to go and see the Empire State Building, I'm going to go and see the Statue of Liberty, and I'm going to do a New York High Line. And it really is fantastic.
Graham and Tim, you've been on this project since the beginning, I think. So how did the idea come about, and what would be your long-term sort of success as an attraction in its own right, but also connecting communities? What was the inspiration for the project? Was it the High Line in New York?
Not just the High Line. I think the High Line's come to prominence over the last few years, and it's shown a lot of people what you can do with these sort of long linear routes, otherwise actually quite difficult to design and do something productive with. But you've got the Camden High Line, and you've got in Castlefield and Manchester, you've got this new civic space which is opened, and suddenly it becomes a sort of vibrant attraction in its own right and makes it a community feature, but it also just allows for iconic pieces of urban fabric to be reimagined, reused, and brought back into everyday use again. You know, it become very vibrant spaces. We don't yet know exactly what the long-term future is for the viaduct, because since the integrated rail plan came out last year, the government, in cutting back the HS2 plans, also said that they'd like to look again at mass transit for Leeds. And of course, Network Rail are now looking at the viaduct again in a slightly different light. So we've got to be slightly careful about how much we push the idea of an urban parkway and we talk about it in terms of the next New York High Line. But either way, I think one of the core things about this project is that it's got a fantastic potential for connectivity. You know, if there was an underlying reason for developing this project, it would be for the urban regeneration potential that the viaduct has. And I think that has been one of the kind of unifying principles, if not the kind of founding principles of the scheme. You know, when we first all kind of met around the table in the midnight bell talking about what might be, you know, we didn't really know what was going to be around the corner exactly. And so now we suddenly find ourselves with a long-term vision for urban renewal, and we've got meanwhile space to help us promote that idea, and it seems like we've come a long way. So yeah, the urban renewal is the answer to the question.
The world will be able to see the vision. Actually experience it, touch it, feel it. That's the plan. Leeds is hosting a sort of cultural festival in 2023, and it'd be great to have something around at that time.
Yes.
And Tim particularly has arranged a few meetings with that crowd, that party, those guys that are arranging that, and something may well come of that.
Because obviously it started in the Midnight Bell, and there's a group of you very passionate about this, and you've achieved a huge amount, and you're all doing this pro bono. What are the disciplines involved, and how have you engaged with the community, and what's their role been in this project?
There are currently, I think, about 28 people involved regularly with this project. We meet regularly in all sorts of manners, teams meetings and things. Everybody's had so much in this, and that mix of people is people who have worked on the railways, it's designers, it's people who live or work in and around Holbeck, it's councillors, it's professionals, it's people who've got small businesses. And it really is a community interest at heart kind of group of people. To move things forward, 12 of those people became directors of a charity organisation called the Holbeck Viaduct Project, which is classed as a CIC. Tim's the chairman, I'm one of the co-directors. That's been one of the big milestones, really. So it becomes official rather than just ideas.
And also other stakeholders can do business with. I think it was slightly vague as to who you might be talking to. So it helps other people focus and direct their discussions with us. You know, for example, Network Rail, to be able to set up a conversation with them, we had to set up a project and they had to be able to deal with a body of people. You know, we were just a loose assortment of kind of interested locals until that point. So now we have a bit more status. You can start to do fundraising. You can start to focus your energies a little bit more in a more defined way.
So you've had these sort of milestones and steps, and putting the charitable body together was obviously a milestone. What have been some of the challenges in bringing this project to life, and how have you overcome those? And are there any more that you're facing at the moment? I think it'd be interesting for people to hear how to navigate this type of project, make it successful.
First questions that we faced was, well, how many people do you have on a board of a CIC to get this running? You need to be representative, or we wanted to be representative, which indeed I think we are. But Graham, correct me if I'm wrong, but getting 11 people to agree on something can be a challenge in itself. So you have to find a way of having that conversation and coming to some conclusions without putting it to the board and, you know, getting a conclusion to the question in 3 months' time. We're very focused on delivery at the moment and expediting that kind of process. So actually, it can be quite a challenge. So those are some of the parameters that we faced when we were setting it up. But I feel like we're now starting to divide up the membership of the board into design groups, fundraising groups, and comms. And we're now starting to find our own roles and positions within the CIC and making things streamlined as possible.
We've been talking about the Holbeck Viaduct for a few months now, and I know you've made great progress in the last few months. And as you've said, sort of recently, it's becoming more and more real. You've navigated various processes. Where are you right now in terms of bringing the regeneration of the Holbeck Viaduct to life? And what are the next sort of challenges or opportunities that you're faced with?
Since the project now has an official body that people can talk to, as Tim says, it's meant we've been able to speak to the right people in the right organisation. So, for example, Network Rail were a huge stakeholder. They actually own the viaduct. We've been able to get through to the right people and therefore start a really good dialogue with them. That also includes local landowners, because obviously we need local landowners to allow us a bit of their land to actually get up there. And when we're talking about the meanwhile space for next year, we've managed to start a really good dialogue with a local developer in Leeds called CEG. We're doing some inner city, urban, fantastic development quite near the station in the canal area called Temple Works. Their project is a long phase, and their later phases include land wrapped around the viaduct, so they can say, yeah, you can use our land to get some sort of access up there. We're currently designing that as a group of people. We've got some fantastic ideas. Some of them will cost a lot more than others, so we need to be realistic. We're just homing in on that solution. We're at a stage where in a couple of weeks we'll be going back to CEG and saying, right, this is our proposal. We've shown the ideas to Network Rail. Network Rail have got very strict parameters about leaving the viaduct intact. making sure that it is temporary, doesn't get left there. We don't ruin any infrastructure in the viaduct. They're very keen that the project we do or hope to do in 2023 is for a short length of track, it's for a short period of time, and it is removable. That gives us quite a few tricky design parameters, but we've come up with all sorts of ideas to do that. In the last 6 months, we've got to that stage from just ideas.
I think it's probably also worth adding that one of the main drivers to what we're doing as part of this urban renewal process is to build consensus as to what we want out of this space. Graham and myself, you know, we both work in the local area and we have a vested interest in the urban realm around us. And both directly and from a professional point of view, you know, we have our own vision, I guess, for what we'd like to see for Leeds and the southwest of Leeds particularly. And this is a lot about consensus building, getting a groundswell of people, local businesses, local landowners, local residents, the business improvement district, you know, landowners like CEG and so forth, but large infrastructure people like Network Rail, local council, local politicians, getting them all together in the same room, using Leeds 2023 as a vehicle to deliver or focus that consensus and help take the conversation forward. And that's what I think has been missing over the last, oh, I don't know, probably 20 years anyway. You know, one of your early questions was, why did you get into this project in the first place? This has been the stuff of landscape architecture students' major design portfolios since probably 20, 25 years ago. It's a great space. It's really interesting. It's iconic heritage status. It looks great. It's right through the middle of the town. And it's a space that people have loved to get their hands on and do something with. And it's just been sitting there derelict. So it's a real opportunity for a lot of people to get involved again. And with the Twitter handles that we've got, it's got more visibility. And with this podcast even, you know, a lot more people will know about it, hear about it, and want to do something about it. And that's all part of the process.
Yeah, and part of a bigger, you know, idea of improving the whole of that area or adding to that area. I don't know how easy this is to answer, but you guys have clearly got, and as a group, a very clear vision of not just what the viaduct would look like, but actually what the transformational effect on Leeds or the southwest of Leeds would be. We're an audio podcast. Could you paint a picture of what you would love it to look like if it became a permanent space?
There's a little list here of what this can achieve. I'll just reel through this because I do this all the time. So biggest one is integrating communities. This viaduct passes through traditional industrial areas, traditional residential areas, a city centre, an old historic industrial area that's under regeneration into residential, and goes towards the football ground. You can imagine the amount of people and users that can use that. It's huge, is this integrating communities thing, and the fact that it's got an end. It would create huge employment benefits and economical growth. You imagine what happens around any piece of infrastructure at a junction or a start point. Things just happen. Businesses just get created. It passes through areas where there's schools and school kids can use it for educational benefits. We might have kind of planting areas. We might have history notices. Just getting out, walking, cycling, going up and down, getting in the fresh air has huge health and well-being benefits for everybody. I've commuted past this viaduct nearly every day for the last sort of 40 years or so, either by cycle, walking, car, travel under it twice a day, and it's just there. Not just what everybody recalls it, sees it, breathes it, touches it, but what it was built for, how well it was built in 1882. So it's like a legacy thing. And then it creates this kind of biodiverse linear line, curvy line, right through the heart of all this busy world. And when you stand up there, high above rooftops and things, in this world you've never been to and never had a view of Leeds and areas of Leeds from there, it's quite spectacular.
What are the opportunities up there for planting and, you know, having it as a area to work with? Because what's great, I guess, the challenge and the opportunity of having quite specific constraints, how exciting is that as a landscape architect to work with?
Well, huge potential, basically, which is quite exciting. We, as a practice, have been doing quite a lot of meanwhile space design. won a Landscape Institute Award back in 2018 for it. You know, the Landscape Institute has been really trying to push this agenda because it's a part in a process of urban renewal. It's not necessarily the end point, but a vehicle for promoting ideas, promoting design, promoting even having a discussion about what is possible and moving things on. And that goes back to what Graham was saying, in that it's been here for a long time. It's just been stagnating, I guess, is the word. And it's just like it's an underexploited asset. So in terms of what's the potential of it, it's huge. There's two ways of looking at this. One is the meanwhile space, and one is the kind of longer term urban regeneration potential and what that looks like, the physical manifestation of what this might be. In terms of the meanwhile space, we're looking at it in terms of an event space. We're thinking about getting people up onto the track for 2 months of 2023 to give them a fresh perspective on the urban environment in the southwest of the city center. We're thinking of lighting displays. We're thinking of live events. We're thinking music. We're thinking of culture. We're thinking of sculpture. We're thinking of the planting potential. And if that sounds a little bit sort of airy-fairy or a little bit kind of elusive, you know, when we last did a meanwhile space in York back in 2018, just creating space gives you suddenly a platform. It's transformative. It lets people experience space in a different way. That's why Castlefield in Manchester has been such a success, because suddenly people have got a place that excites visually, but it suddenly a busker comes and starts playing his fiddle and you've got a whole bunch of people listening. What do they want to do? They might want to sit down if they're in their late 70s, or they might want to stand up and chat with their friends if they're a 19-year-old student, and they might want to eat their burrito around the corner, or they might want to, you know, whatever it is. It's about the gathering of people, and suddenly an empty space becomes a vibrant space. And vibrant spaces are safe, vibrant spaces are exciting, and just adds that sense of dynamism to any urban environment. So, you know, that's really at the core of this. So that's for the meanwhile space. But then longer term, you know, what does that look like? Well, our vision document has options. When we were writing the vision document, we didn't want to be too prescriptive, because one was we weren't sure about what the long-term requirements were going to be from an operational point of view for Network Rail. So we didn't want to preclude any potential future use as a rail connection, because that too would serve the community. But the second part of that is we also want it to be consensual. We want it to be something that the local community can get behind, that is community enhancing and useful to the local community. There's no point in putting up designers coming in and saying, oh, we need to make allotments up here. We need to make an urban park. We need to make, when actually people just want to get from A to B. They want to get a cycleway that takes you from Holbeck to Beeston, or they want a walking route from the center of town to Ellen Road, you know, to watch the matches. So we want to put ideas out there and say what's possible, rather than be too definitive at this point about what they actually will look like.
So there'll be a lot of community engagement in terms of understanding what out of all of these options is most important to the community it's serving. I like that. That really resonates, that it's serving the community. So whatever works, what's best for the community, will be part of how the viaduct evolves.
Otherwise, you risk being irrelevant.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
yeah.
You spend a lot of money doing something that just isn't actually what people want or need or is useful to them.
That's why the group's so fantastic, because me and Tim are designers, different aspects. I've mentioned before, there's local councillors really on the ground. A lot of people in the group who are really local are really up for joining in terms of that community engagement.
You've talked about lots of different disciplines and professions that are represented. Tell us about the original group, but also how do you feel you've been successful in gaining traction amongst the wider community? Have you actively sought support, or has support come to you? It'd be great to hear both of those.
I think it's a bit of both, really. There was definitely a core group of key players. The treasurer is a project manager for Wakefield Council, for example. We've got a lecturer from Leeds Beckett University, local interest again. We've got a local heritage planner called Joe Raper from ID Planning. We've got a chap who's worked on the railways, now into health and safety and actually consults for the railways. A lady called Philippa, who works for Johnson & Johnson, who are a huge kind of medical pharmacy company. Philip has been speaking to her bosses, for example, about potentially sponsoring fundraising. That's the sort of help we're going to need in the future. But Philippa lives locally. She's an artist. She lives and works in Beeston and Holbeck. James, who is one of the original sort of two or three directors, James is an economist and lives locally. Tim from Urban Wilderness, he's the chairman. I've got a lady who's a civil engineer who's worked on railways, on bridges, on cycleways for Sustrans, a chap called Mark Fletcher, who's a PR employee for a huge kind of national bingo chain. He's from Leeds, lives in Nottingham, and his forte is advertising, marketing, setting up things like Facebook groups and things like that. We've got Ed Carlisle, who's the local councillor for Holbeck. And also, one of the other directors is another architect called Hiro Asso, who's worked on the Leeds station scheme with Tim. So it really is a busy little group. There's a chap called Kerry as well. He runs a huge community group in Holbeck, right near the viaduct. So you can see it's kind of how many people have just got this heart and interest and want to see something happen. And even if in February, Network Rail turn around and say, sorry, guys, game's off, we are going to open this up as a light rail kind of thing. It's a win for everybody because it does the community links. It keeps the heritage assets. It keeps this thing there forever and it becomes useful again. So it's a win.
What about people who've joined you on the journey, Tim?
When James Whitley and Ed Carlisle were first discussing this, you know, years ago, this has been like their kind of brainchild in terms of the Holbeck Viaduct group and getting a load of people together. But that's where it started. The grassroots of this was local residents, local councillors saying, we need to do something with this. This is a great asset. Let's do something with it. So, you know, it's not something that's artificial or something that's money driven or something that's, it's got its own life and people are jumping on, which is really great to see. And when we put the vision document out there, we wanted it to be a document that represented the views of the local community, not something that was pushing an agenda per se. We didn't want people to jump on and say, oh yeah, we can do master planning. We can do, you know, huge urban regeneration potential. We, you know, get the money men in and start kind of, you know, creating a monster. You know, it was about saying, this is a great asset. What do you think? And people naturally, you know, the business improvement district, they said, why not? Of course, this is in everyone's interest. You had the local authority, the local council saying, of course, why wouldn't you want to do this? Suddenly they start talking to Network Rail, who they meet regularly anyway. And then they start talking to the local politicians and the local councillors from the Beeston ward and from the Holbeck ward are talking to the local authority. Suddenly Hilary Benn, you know, is like, why wouldn't I support this? You've got urban strategists like Hiro Asso going, look, we've done this already at King's Cross in London. Look at the huge positive spin-offs that came out of that in terms of community enhancement. Why wouldn't anyone be behind this? And so suddenly you've got this groundswell of public opinion. I guess, yes, we have gone out and prodded and cajoled and talked and so on, but actually people are coming to us now and that's the way we want it. We don't want it to be this thing that's top down, delivered for the benefit of the local community when actually it's only people like us maybe that benefits.
Really looking forward to coming up in 2023 to the Meanwhile space. What have you got between now and then that you've got to get through and pass through?
We've got the design coming along for Meanwhile Space. The people involved in that, again, the huge group potential here. Tim's practice Urban Wilderness Landscape Designers. We've kind of split the project into bits, really, but we're talking to each other all the time. So it's a real team project, having a look at the actual vertical access way and how that can work. Boro Happold, for example, we've got an incredible resource internally, international engineering multidisciplinary company. The amount of help they're giving this team pro bono into all sorts of really ingrained specialisms, wind, structure, amount of people that can fit in around the space and move around, all that kind of stuff. So design-wise, we've kind of got that covered. So we've got the contacts covered at the right places in terms of Network Rail, local landowners. We're talking to the right people. We've got this design coming along. The next stage is to make a planning application for that. That will be great because it will raise the profile. But what we really need to do is fundraise, get part of our team really going hell for leather on fundraising. And it's not that simple, because let's imagine this thing's just about to be complete. So it's cost X million pounds and we need to run this thing forever. In order to get that fundraising, we need to show that A, we've got things like title, leaseholds, ownerships, the structural reports, all these ducks need to be in a row. The biggest one of all is, what's the business plan for this to run and be managed and operated for perpetuity? And there are organisations in the UK, fantastic kind of semi-charitable organisations like the National Trust, like the Land Trust, for example, who can help. So in terms of getting all the ducks in the row for the fundraising, we've got a plan for that.
And is that fundraising for the meanwhile space? Is this really for the lot for both? Yeah, meanwhile and then long term. Yeah, and the meanwhile is kind of also proves, yeah, will help with the fundraising long term, because you're proving out a number of concepts and ideas, right?
That's right. You know, our core mission at the moment is to get funding for the meanwhile space, because that's what's focusing our minds for the delivery of this interim project for, you know, September 2023. We're talking to the main stakeholders, like landowners, like CEG and Network Rail and the City Council. And as Graham said, we're looking for, probably, we think at the current time, an anchor sponsor that might put up 50%. And that might be one of the big national players, like National
Furniture.
Like Furniture. Why not? And if you'd like to be the funding anchor, then please come and talk to us. You know where we live. But it might be someone like the National Lottery Heritage Fund, for example, who are all about these kind of community-centric, community-building, consensual projects centered around a heritage asset. So it works on a number of different levels, that. And then local community residents can then start do that volunteering, put physical money into it and start contributing in lots of ways.
It starts gaining momentum, yeah, and pulling it all in.
Just going back to the meanwhile space, the little piece of land that CEG have very kindly said, yes, you can use this. It's quite tucked away, but it is very close to the city centre and it is very close to busy roads and, of course, a huge, busy railway infrastructure. The principles of the design to actually get up there, there's an opportunity, A, to be a bit of a beacon, tell the world with branding what this is, but get it noticed, they can understand it, see it more. That's one aspect. But then once they've gone up the staircase, the lift, and got to that height and popped onto the viaduct itself, it's then that second experience of touching, feeling what this thing could look like and feel like in the future and the views you get, etc.
It is a journey, though. The meanwhile space is there to facilitate long-term change. That's the way we're looking at it.
It's actually a really great opportunity for whoever it is to be involved, in terms of the viaduct is important, but as you say, it's the renewal and the regeneration of the space around it, which is really exciting as well.
Yeah, otherwise it just is an expensive folly.
Yep.
We need to get the world to believe that this can be real. So now there is a CIC, a group, a company, that's part of that belief. And I think when it's been talked about before, great idea. But don't forget, we haven't got any money. We don't own the viaduct, Network Rail do. We don't own the land around it. Other private companies do, and Leeds City Council do, and highways departments do, etc. If you went into something and said, oh, we don't own the land, we don't own the structure, we haven't got any money, well, nobody's going to believe you. So that belief that this can happen is huge, I think, getting people to believe in it.
We've tried to arrange this podcast recording for possibly 4 months, and we wanted to do it in Leeds on the viaduct, but train strikes have thwarted most attempts. But at least we've got to talk about this.
Ironically,
yes. we'll do an update in 2023 during the Festival of Culture, which will be really cool. Thank you both for coming in and telling us about this amazing project, the bigger vision, and how you've made it achievable, how you've made it possible, how you're making it possible, and looking forward to seeing it when the meanwhile space is delivered.
Thank you, Catherine. Thank you to everybody at Furnitures for giving us this opportunity to tell the world.
Great to have a platform. Yeah, thanks very much, Catherine.
Tim, why did you want to become a landscape architect or landscape designer, and what do you love most about it?
I think it's about improving people's lives. I think as a landscape architect, you have this fantastic opportunity to create dynamic outdoor spaces that help people congregate, focus activity, and become dynamic spaces to be in a position of influence, but influence subtly. We're not going to be the next prime minister, but it's about affecting people's lives, a lot of people's lives, in a number of different ways. And the more complex those interactions are, the better.
Yeah, it's a very fortunate, privileged position to be in. What is one thing that landscape architects and the profession could do right now, if you had to boil it down to one thing, which I know is difficult, to help combat the climate disaster?
Well, our practice is about bringing the best of the world beyond the urban environment into the cityscape. I don't mean it to be the rural idyll so much as all the things that you think about of halcyon landscapes, beauty, comfort, safety, even just the fact that it's greenery. You know, your eye, your mind responds very positively to the color green. It calms, it enriches, and it's about bringing that from the countryside and bringing that into the urban environment and creating comfortable, exciting, interesting spaces for people.
And if you could put a bench in one spot in the world, where would it be and why?
Well, I'm from Scotland. I come from Aberdeen. The Highlands are very close to my heart. There's some fantastic views all around Scotland, but there's one on the River Dee near Banchory, looking over the river, a little place called Patach. Just quiet, serenity, the water rippling past you, watching the salmon leap. That's quite special. So great place for a bench.
Lovely. Thank you. Graham, what made you want to become an architect, and what do you love most about being an architect?
It's the creativity. It's the fact that what we have designed is there forever to kind of show your grandkids in the future. When the young school guys come, work experience, they ask, why should I do this profession? And I say exactly that. You know, if you grow up and be an accountant and you're taking your grandkids down the street one day, you can say, oh, I did some books for that company over there. When you're actually designing something, creating something in architecture, you can say, I designed that, grandkids. I think that's it.
A similar thing for a landscape architect. When you feel like you've made it in life, you can say the Ordnance Survey changed as a result of that project.
Wow. Lasting legacies.
Yeah, yeah.
And Graham, if you could put a bench in one spot in the world, where would it be and why?
My favourite place in the whole world where I go most, apart from Yorkshire, is Cornwall. And there is a spot on North Cornish coast called Bassini Bay. And it outlooks over the Atlantic. There's little islands, rocks, waves are massive. There's a little beach at the bottom and surfers go there. It's a bit of an adventurous cove to get to, but it's a beautiful spot.
I love that we've got the top and the bottom of the country represented with your benches. Thank you so much, Tim and Graham. It's been really, really great to talk to you, and a really enjoyable morning conversation. Thank you.